You're tuned to the Mendocino Country Independent News Hour. I'm your host, Christina Onnestead, co-publisher of the Mendocino Country Independent. We're a monthly publication of local news, arts, culture, and entertainment here in Mendocino County. Today we're going to speak with Daryl Cherney about his new film, Who Bombed Judy Berry? We'll also be visited in the studio with 5th District Supervisor Dan Hamburg. He's going to discuss local politics, and including the Marine Life Protection Act, what it is and whose interests it's really protecting. We're going to take a short musical break here. This is a wonderful local band, the Druid Sisters Tea Party. Then we'll be back with local headlines from this region and interviews. Mendocino Country Independent News Hour. I'm co-publisher Christina Onnestead. We're broadcast live every Monday here on KMEC LP 105.1 FM Ukiah at the Mendocino Environmental Center, and we're also on KYBU every week in Covelo 96.9 FM. Thanks for joining us today. About 100 people rallied against racism in Ukiah this past weekend. The move is in response to national murders of Trayvon Martin and the local killing of Jamal Andrews, both African-American men. In Ukiah, the community rallied to acknowledge the importance of a diverse community. The local group called CORE, Conversations on Race and Privilege, organized the event. As the Independent reports in this month's edition, the District Attorney's Office will not pursue a hate crime enhancement in the Jamal Andrews murder case. Neighbors told the Independent suspect Billy Nordbury had made racial slurs against Andrews in the past. Jamal Andrews was shot dead on his front lawn in front of his partner and 7-month-old son January 24th. The preliminary hearing is scheduled for April 10th. District Attorney David Eister told the Independent, quote, if it's not a hate crime, it would be unethical to try it as such. And if it is a hate crime and you can't prove it, it hurts the case, unquote. Eister continued that just because someone makes racist slurs and later commits a crime, it doesn't constitute a hate crime. A murder charge carries a 25-year sentence, according to Eister, and the use of a gun in the crime carries another 25-year sentence. If 33-year-old Nordbury were convicted, he would be in prison for 50 years before being eligible for parole at age 83. A Justice for Jamal Andrews committee has a Facebook page for updates on the case. People can read more about the case in this month's edition of the Mendocino Country Independent. The Leonard Moore Cooperative, one of two medical marijuana dispensaries in Mendocino Village, closed its doors this past weekend due to federal threats to their landlords. A letter signed by federal attorney Melinda Haig states the landlord's renting to an illegal business could result in asset forfeiture of the property involved. The Leonard Moore Collective will remain, but it no longer has a storefront. Mendocino Village now has one medical marijuana dispensary remaining. That's Levenick Cooperative. The Ukiah Planning Commission has voted to not approve Walmart's proposed 47,000 square foot expansion. Occupy Ukiah and Occupy Mendocino are organizing to stop foreclosures in Mendocino County. The groups are petitioning the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors to enact a moratorium on home foreclosures in Mendocino County. You can read more about these stories and more in this month's Independent. Our paper is available at Mulligan Books, Dig Music, Ukiah Brewing Company, and here at the MEC here in Ukiah. It's also available at Mariposa Market in Willits, and it's available on the coast at Frankie's Pizza, Corners of the Mouth, in the Mendocino Cafe in Mendocino Village, and you can also catch a copy at Headlands Coffee Shop and Harvest Market in Fort Bragg. We're also online, and we're still a work in progress online, at www.mendocinocountry.com. So I recently spoke with Daryl Cherney. We spoke over this past weekend as he was driving back from two sold-out film screenings in Los Angeles. That's of his recent documentary, Who Bombed Judy Berry? The film will be screened this week in Willits. That's this Wednesday and Thursday at the Noyo Theater at 7 o'clock. There's going to be questions and answers, ask-a-words, with Daryl Cherney, who will be present. So we met here at the MEC. This is a historical building. This is a place where he and Judy Berry organized around Redwood Summer and the justice struggles to protect old-growth redwood forests. They organized out of here. So we spoke here at the MEC about the film and the story.
May 24th, 1990, Judy Berry and I were car bombed while we were organizing to save the redwoods for something called Redwood Summer, a season-long campaign.
And that was here in Northern California.
In Mendocino and Humboldt counties. And we were immediately arrested by the FBI and the Oakland police, basically for transporting explosives, for car bombing ourselves, as they might say, even though the bomb itself had a motion trigger, which meant that the bomb would only go off in a moving vehicle. It was hidden under the driver's seat. Well, one of the first agents on the scene was Special Agent Frank Doyle, the head of the FBI's terror division in San Francisco, and also a man who taught something called bomb school in Humboldt County, California, just 30 days before the bombing. Bomb school was interesting because they were blowing up cars with pipe bombs just a month before Judy Berry's car was blown up with a pipe bomb. They were doing it on lumber company land that belonged to Louisiana Pacific, Judy's principal adversary. And when the bomb went off, Frank Doyle turned to one of his students who, coincidentally or not, happened to be at the scene of the bombing. He turned to a student and said that this was the final exam, that Judy's bombed car was the final exam. We have that on videotape, the FBI's own videotape. So we know that because bomb school was held on lumber company property and the chief of the terror division was also good friends with the chief of Louisiana Pacific Security, that there was a personal relationship between the FBI, a personal and professional relationship between the FBI and the Louisiana Pacific Timber Company. Now, that doesn't make anybody guilty alone, but there is so much more evidence to goes along with that, principally, that right off the bat, Special Agent Frank Doyle started lying about the bombing itself. He said that the bomb was in the back seat in plain view where Judy and I should have seen it, when it was actually hidden under the driver's seat where she never would have seen it. He failed to mention that it was a booby trap with a motion trigger that would only go off in a moving car. The Oakland police and FBI said that nails that Judy was carrying in the back of her car, because she was a carpenter at California Yurts and a foreman of a construction crew, that the nails in the back of Judy Berry's car matched nails in the bomb, when the nails in the back of Judy Berry's car that she was carrying were roofing nails and the nails strapped to the bomb were finishing nails. They looked completely different. So all these lies told immediately on the spot indicated that this frame job was planned in advance, and that law enforcement, in conjunction with the lumber companies, had some knowledge of it before it happened.
What exactly were you and Judy doing that warranted such attention?
Well, on the day of the bombing, we were organizing for Redwood Summer, which was going to bring, and did bring, thousands of kids and adults to Northern California to defend the Redwoods. It was an election year, Forest Forever. Proposition 130 was on the ballot. That was going to reform timber practices, ban clear-cutting, protect endangered species, expand stream protection zones. So billions of dollars were, in fact, at stake. You know, the kind of money that was at stake that might make somebody want to kill an organizer like Judy Barry. And Judy had the gift of gab. Thousands of people would come to hear her speak.
When you say billions of dollars were at stake, do you mean from logging?
Yes, that if you banned clear-cutting, the timber companies would make less money. If you reformed forestry practices, there would be less of a profit. So yes, billions of dollars were in fact at stake through this ballot initiative called Forest Forever. And Judy was organizing Redwood Summer, which was designed to blockade the logging of ancient redwood trees until the election came and hopefully would win. As it turns out, the industry used the bombing against this ballot initiative to say, don't vote for Forest Forever, it's supported by terrorists. That was right in the California ballot pamphlet as well as in various advertisements. So there was a direct correlation between the bombing and the ballot initiative and the campaign to try to stop, that successfully stopped Forest Forever from winning the California state ballot. It lost by 1%. But Judy was also bringing lumber company employees, timber workers, loggers, mill workers, truck drivers, together with environmentalists. She was building bridges because she herself was a union organizer, and she was starting unions in Pacific Lumber, Louisiana Pacific, and Georgia Pacific Lumber companies all at the same time. Sometimes people ask me, how could Judy do all that? And I said, well, she never slept. She was tireless. And she raised two children as a single mom. So Judy was able to transcend the whole dynamic, the whole ideology of the oppressor, which is divide and conquer. In order to manipulate the little people here on planet Earth, you have to divide them and pit them against each other. Judy was doing the antithesis of that. She was bringing people together, the loggers and environmentalists, and that made her a target for sure.
So you were bombed, and then you were charged as being the responsible for your own bombing.
Yes. David Brower, former CEO of the Sierra Club and founder of Earth Island Institute and Friends of the Earth, said that we were being accused of self-assassination. That was, of course, made tongue-in-cheek. But yes, we were actually not charged. We were simply arrested. But the public doesn't always understand the difference between being arrested and being charged. You're arrested by the police, and you're charged by the district attorney. We were never charged with the crime, but our names were dragged through the mud. And so the move by law enforcement and the lumber companies to discredit Earth First, Redwood Summer, and also the alliance between timber workers and environmentalists succeeded to a point. You know, I wrote a song, Who Bombed Judy Barry, right after the bombing. We sang it for Judy in August of 1990. She was bombed on May 24th, 1990. And what the song basically said was, regardless of who bombed Judy Barry, there was a system behind it, that it was a whole mentality that bombed her, not just a particular individual. And the system and the mentality was that of the timber industry in allegiance with the FBI.
Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, the FBI was created in 1915 or so to go after the industrial labor movement. And by 1920, they were rounding up 20,000 labor union people at a time, particularly with the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. And from its onset, it's been a political police force. working on behalf of the status quo, the 1%, as they are now known, the wealthy of this country, the corporate titans. So as we go up to the present day, we see the FBI hasn't changed much with their COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, disinformation campaigns against the American Indian movement, the Black Panthers, and the civil rights movement, so many others. And it takes us right up to the environmental movement and Earth First in the 1980s and 90s.
What was it like for you being the victim of an attempted assassination?
First, I want to make it clear that I was in the car by fate that day. I was not supposed to be in the passenger seat with Judy. I mean, Judy and I always traveled together, and we had been lovers for 2 years. Right up until that point, we were in the process of breaking up. So we actually weren't supposed to be riding in the car that day, but Judy's car was pulling out of Oakland, and I actually had a choice of two cars to ride in. And I said, who should I ride with? And Judy said, me. And that's how I got in Judy's car that day. In some ways, I'm glad I was there because I was not badly injured, but I was able to talk to Judy as she moaned in pain. Her pelvis was shattered. Her leg was partially paralyzed. Her coccyx and sacrum, her lower vertebrae, were pulverized and dislocated. She had intestinal damage. And I just told her over and over again, I love you. You're going to make it. I love you. You're going to make it. And then immediately after the bombing, I was able to talk to the media from my jail cell, even. There was a payphone in the jail cell, and I called the press. Collect. So I was able to be a voice for both of us when she couldn't speak because she was unconscious in the ICU, the intensive care unit. And then 7 years later, after surviving the bombing, she passed away from cancer. So again, I was alive to carry on our lawsuit against the FBI and Oakland Police, a lawsuit that said that they knew we were in fact innocent. Right from the get-go, they knew we didn't bomb ourselves. They knew it wasn't our bomb. But they lied in order to silence us, to discredit us. And that is a violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution that guarantees us freedom of speech. We also charged them successfully with violations of the Fourth Amendment, which protects us from false arrest and illegal search and seizure. So if I hadn't been in the car that day, who knows how differently things would have gone. Maybe they would have accused me of trying to kill Judy. But I got in the car, and pretty much it changed reality forever. How did it feel? I watched the woman that I loved from the day I met her to the day she passed have her body ruined before my very eyes. And from that moment onward, I had a feeling of helplessness that no matter how good I was at anything that I could master, I could never put Judy Barry back together again. There was no amount of healing that I or anybody could do that could lessen her pain and make her whole again. So in that respect, for as long as Judy lived, I was always a little sad. There was always a sadness I carried around with me. So that's how it felt.
What was it like to have your name, as you put it, rung through the mud?
I was pretty indignant about it and pretty angry. I've always had a great affection and affiliation for working people. My father was a union man. I've worked hard all my life. Even if I've been a volunteer, I still put in a lot of labor every single day. And I have great respect for people who work hard, like loggers and mill workers. So to have myself and Judy accused of being bombers and having our names dragged through the mud and discredited in our own communities was deeply angering. And yet at the same time, I kind of have a bit of a detached personality. I can kind of look at things and, you know, like an outside observer and say, you know, I know who I am, and I'm not going to allow what other people think of me bother me too much because there's work to do. We need to find the bomber. We need to save the Redwoods, not necessarily in that order, and we need to go on with our lives. But, you know, I grew up in New York City, You mess with me, I'm not going to let go. I'm going to find out who bombed Judy and myself. I'm pretty tenacious. It's how I was raised. So I've committed myself until the bomber is found to keep on that quest, to find out who bombed Judy Barry. And to that end, we produced a film, Who Bombed Judy Barry? And if I may just say, the purpose of the movie is fourfold. One, to educate people about tactics and strategies that Earth First was particularly adept at, and that Judy Barry in particular was very articulate in explaining. Two, to inspire people. Our movie's filled with victories. It's filled with humor and song. Even though it addresses a serious subject, there's a lightness to it. People laugh throughout the movie as well as cry, because Judy was the funniest person I ever knew. And the songs we sang were funny, like The FBI Stole My Fiddle. Third purpose of the movie is to educate people who the historical figure Judy Barry was and is. We're short on heroes these days, and in particular women heroes or sheroes, perhaps. And I think the world needs to know. I think the world needs Judy Barry more than ever. In fact, I had an epiphany while I was working on this movie, somewhere in the middle of it, the 2.5 years we worked on it. I woke up one day and I said, oh my God, I'm still organizing with Judy. I'm still working with Judy. Because her words and her speeches and her presence appear to be just as powerful from the screen as they were in real life. And the fourth purpose of the movie is to trigger a legitimate law enforcement investigation of who bombed Judy Barry, even after 22 years. This case is extremely solvable. There's a mountain of evidence. And if they can solve the Medgar Evers murder case 30 years later and go after the Birmingham church bombers from the civil rights days 30 or 40 years later, we can find out who bombed Judy Barry 22 years later. And I'm going to say on this radio station, we are going to find out who bombed Judy Barry. We're pretty darn close.
So on that topic, on April 12th, you have a court hearing coming up. Tell us about that.
When we sued the FBI and the Oakland Police, as I explained before, we were awarded by a jury $4.4 million.
What is it like to know that, to be an American citizen whose own government has thwarted efforts at finding out who your attempted assassin is?
What is it like? Well, oppression by governments goes back as long as there's been governments. Ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, the Middle Ages, Spanish Inquisition, Asia, Africa, United States, South America. It's nothing new here. So it basically, what it was like, it was just made me feel like, okay, we're part of the club. We're part of the world community that has been persecuted by governments. We're not necessarily super special because of that, but what makes our case special is we have an opportunity to find out the truth. So it feels like a privilege to be able to have the ability in this country where there's still a modicum of democracy left and openness left, even though it's dwindling quickly. It feels like a great opportunity and honor to be able to pursue this.
So you were one of the first cases in the U.S. to have won a lawsuit, a First Amendment violation lawsuit against the FBI. I think that the story, Who Bombed Judy Barry, the documentary that you made, is a real testament to the human spirit.
It is. The movie is framed by Judy Barry giving her deathbed testimony. Here she is with just 30 days left to live. The FBI has been trying to prevent her from testifying at all, and then they try to prevent her from testifying on videotape, which became the framework of our movie many years later, as in now. And you watch a woman in a severely weakened state still muster up strength, Herculean strength, that is really the mark of a true hero. So she then, as she tells her story in somewhat chronological order under oath, we have mountains of video, probably 700 hours from local videographers here in Mendocino and Humboldt down to the Bay Area that we drew from. So whatever Judy talks about, we are able to depict it. She's talking about a tree sit. Cool. We'll show you the tree sit. She's talking about the car bomb. We'll show you the news footage of the bombing. She says that she arrived at a demonstration. We can show you walking out of the van as she goes to the demonstration, because we had an eco-paparazzi that was following us around wherever we went, because we were kind of colorful characters that the videographers loved to video. So that fortuitous set of circumstances made this documentary somewhat easier to tell than if we'd been starting from scratch. And the fact is, this documentary is 100% archival footage. We did no new interviews for this. All the footage is from the past, at the time that the demonstrations, that the lawsuit, that the testimony, that the tree sits, that the speeches were happening. So you're really in the moment for the entire time. And we do tell a story. It has character arcs. You've got twists and turns of the plot. It's a thriller. It's a mystery. And it's a good story. When people say, who's your target audience? My response is, anybody who likes a good story.
I think one of the stories is about the spirit and the perseverance of activists to stand their truth even in the face of repression. Can you talk to that?
Well, you know, when we were bombed, we could have easily have backed down, walked away, said, hey, this is more than we can handle. But as the two principal organizers of Redwood Summer, we knew that if we did that, the rest of the movement might follow suit, because that was exactly what the FBI wanted. They wanted us to back down. So even as wounded as Judy was, and as fearful that we, as we were at the time, that somebody might make a second attempt, we had almost an obligation to not back down, no matter how adversarial the circumstances were. So, yes, we were in their face. We're kind of in-your-face people. You know, East Coasters, Judy from Baltimore, myself from New York, we're in your face. We're in the FBI and Oakland Police's face because they went after us on behalf of the timber industry. There's a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine that I clipped. It's two FBI agents at the door of some average middle-aged, middle-class couple. And the caption says, hi, we're from the FBI and we're here to scare the hell out of you. 90% of what they do is generate fear, try to scare people away from becoming active, to create paranoia. Yes, 10% is physical. They can throw you in jail. They can beat you up. They can make sure you can never work again if they feel like it, like they did during the McCarthy era and the Red Scare. But a lot of it, most of it, is fear. And if we as a people are unafraid, then they've lost 90% of their power over us. Now, of course, what the hell is a government agency in a democratic society doing generating fear over people? Well, as I said, politics as usual, as long as there's been politics. And who are we? We're resistance, standing up for right as usual, as long as there's been resistance. So this is an old story. I think what's different about today than ancient Rome or ancient Egypt is that our biosphere is at stake. The planet is at stake. The human mind is still the same. The torture and atrocities and destruction that we level and wage is still the same. But there's far fewer resources left. And the very fabric of the planet itself, its ozone layer above, its ice caps on our polar, on our poles, are deteriorating alarmingly to the point where we may just be the last generation that could have the honor and privilege of defending life on this planet as we know it. And so whatever fear that I or others might have of the FBI, the Oakland Police, or or whoever bombed Judy Barry and myself, that fear is dwarfed by my fear of losing our planet Earth's ability to house all of us. She's a beautiful planet. It's a wonderful place. Her colors and her sounds and her animals, even the people. So wonderful. What a gift. To destroy that for a McDonald's hamburger or some paper towels, or to be able to burn fossil fuels for a few score year before they're all used up just so we can get somewhere faster and can live farther away. It just seems sheer lunacy. To that end, I'll share with you what, you know, I'll paraphrase Albert Einstein and say that the challenge for humanity is for our spiritual evolution to catch up with our technological evolution.
The voice of Daryl Cherney. He's a filmmaker, the director of Who Bombed Judy Barry? It's a local story, and it's going to be screened locally in Willits at the Noyo Theater this Wednesday and Thursday at 7 p.m. There's going to be a questions and answers to follow with Daryl Cherney. The show starts at 7, and the number to call for more information on the screening is 459-6696. That's area code 707. 459-6696. And there's an update to the mystery of who bombed Judy Barry. In the attempts to find the assassins, the attempted assassins, Daryl Cherney has gone to court requesting the FBI turn over its evidence of the car bombing to an independent forensics laboratory. The FBI has declined that request. Daryl Cherney has been in court over it, and in an order dated March 31st and released today, Honorable Claudia Wilkin has ordered the FBI to turn over that evidence. It's evidence in the 1990 car bomb assassination attempt of Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney. The FBI has been ordered to turn over the evidence to a third-party forensics laboratory for independent testing. That order just came down today. The FBI has about 2 weeks to appeal that decision. We'll be covering this issue as it continues to evolve. You can find more on our monthly paper, The Independent, and our website is MendocinoCountry.com. You are listening to the Mendocino Country Independent. We're broadcast live here at KMEC 105.1 FM in Ukiah at the Mendocino Environmental Center, and we're also broadcast on KYBU 96.9 FM in Covelo. I'm Christina Onnestad, the co-publisher of The Independent. Thanks for tuning in. In the studios with me is Dan Hamburg, and we're going to take a musical break for a minute, and then we'll be back to discuss all things local politics. Most of the things we'll be talking about will be the Marine Life Protection Act, who it really protects, and what local concerns are about how the Marine Life Protection Act is being enacted. First, here's some local music again, the Druid Sisters Tea Party. The name of this song is Church of the Holy Trees. It's about Earth First and tree sitters. Thank you. Stewart Sisters, Church of the Holy Trees. I'm Christine Armistead, host of the Mendocino Country Independent News Hour. In the studios with me is 5th District Supervisor Dan Hamburg. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Christine.
And so, Dan, we've invited you to speak because you're a supervisor, you're 5th District Supervisor here in Mendocino County, and the region that you represent in our county is the coast. It's part of the coast. It's from Point Arena on up to about Mendocino, Casper, correct?
Actually, I'll be a little more precise. The Wallala River.
Wallala River, okay.
The river that separates the Sea Ranch to the south from
Sonoma County,
Wallala,
to Mendocino
Sea
County.
Ranch, which is Sonoma County, to Wallala, which is Mendocino County. And then the 5th District goes up just south of Casper.
South of Casper, okay.
Yeah.
So there's a letter here that was before the Board of Supervisors last week that's about the Marine Life Protection Act. And in the letter, it's about 2.5, well, it's almost 3 pages, really. And in the letter, the supervisors have noted a series of concerns with the Marine Life Protection Act. So, Dan, as a policymaker, perhaps you can explain to our listeners what the Marine Life Protection Act is, for starters, and then what your concerns are as a representative of the people here.
Okay. I became familiar with the Marine Life Protection Act when I was running for supervisor a couple of years ago. And this actually was an act of the California legislature, actually signed by Governor Schwarzenegger in 1999. And the bill calls for the establishment of marine reserves or marine protected areas all the way up the California coast. So it's been about a 3, maybe even a 4 year process since. Okay, so it passed in 99. Then there were these years where it kind of languished and not much was happening. It was just this bill that had been passed, but without any funds being appropriated in any budgets to actually implement the bill. So lo and behold, a group emerged, calling itself the Resources Legacy Foundation Fund. And this is an organization that was formed with funds from corporate foundations.
Like the Hewlett-Packard Foundation.
The Packard Foundation is one. The Intel Foundation is one. The Getty Oil Foundation is another. I think there's maybe one or two that I've left out.
There's also state money that went into this as well, correct?
I actually don't know that. Most of what I've been aware of is this RLFF money. And I have to say that I took an immediate dislike. I mean, I'm an environmentalist, and, you know, I've been involved in environmental issues here in Mendocino County since the 70s. And, you know, I've almost never met a preservation or conservation program that I wasn't in favor of. But this one just kind of struck me the wrong way, and it probably had something to do with Intel and Packard and, you know, Getty. And also the fact that the way it was structured was with these kingpins who were part of what was called the BRTF, the Blue Ribbon Task Force, that was charged with holding meetings from, you know, all the way from down in San Diego up all the way to Crescent City.
In Southern California, they were basically charged with overseeing the process of establishing these new marine reserves, which would be protected areas for marine wildlife to thrive. Protections would be from anything from just no humans visiting to no fishing, no harvesting, no taking anything from the beach, a variety of different measures.
Right, but oddly enough, not prohibiting industrial exploitation of the ocean, such as offshore oil drilling, wave energy projects, you know, various kinds of various kinds of extraction, you know, in these areas. so-called anthropogenic, you know, man-created activities were not prohibited, and that struck me and others as extremely concerning, because one of the members of the Blue Ribbon Task Force was a woman named Catherine Rias Boyd, who was the president of the Western States Petroleum Organization. Excuse me. And Catherine Rias Boyd was always very clear that she was a proponent of offshore oil drilling, which, you know, you would think somebody from Western States Petroleum Organization, you know, would be. And also, as you looked at this membership of the BRTF, it wasn't exactly stuffed with people for whom the a thriving ocean is the first priority. For example, there were
no members of the Sierra Club were involved, but I think somebody was connected to the NRDC.
There was some big green, what I like to call big green organizations, such as NRDC and
Natural Resources
Ocean
Coalition,
Ocean Conservancy, and some of the big environmental groups were putting money into it and using that money to hire local people to do some of the research that was involved.
So there was a broad base of the different people who are on the task force, from people with oil interests to people with conservation interests.
And also developers.
Harbor developers.
And also
3 years in the making.
And also we did have one Native American on the Blue Ribbon Task Force when they came up to work on this North Coast array, but she was actually from Santa Barbara and was, you know, very unfamiliar with the unique kind of tribal issues up here. Now, this is a complicated issue, and I don't want to make it sound totally one-sided. There are parts of our coast that are overfished and over-harvested, and, you know, there are there are some benefits that have been shown in other parts of the world to creating marine protected areas. But my big problem with it was how it was, in my judgment, imposed on us from outside by this resources legacy fund and by these environmental organizations that may have been very well-meaning, but I would never maintain that outside environmental organizations know more about the environment of Mendocino County, including our coastline, than our local people do. So I was happy with that process.
So in that vein, one of the issues that you address in this letter is the issue of effort shift.
Right.
So what is effort shift, and what is your concern there?
Well, effort shift just means that, you know, if you rope off certain areas of the coast and say, okay, you're not gonna harvest sea urchin, and you're not gonna harvest seaweed, and you're not gonna fish, and you know, it's just gonna move people more intensively to other areas of the coast. So are you really gonna gain anything overall? So, you know, that was one of our concerns. Some water. And there are a lot of other concerns. Another fairly major one was that we don't really see how this is going to be enforced. I mean, given the fact that we already have a real scarcity of wardens on the coast who are enforcing...
Excuse me. Why don't we take a musical break, and we'll be back in a couple minutes.
Feel like it's mine.
All right, Dan Hamburg, 5th District Supervisor.
Okay. So what were we effort talking shift. About? We're talking about effort shift. And, you know, effort shift is just, you know, a shorthand way of saying if you close off some areas and particularly, you know, one of the things that this BRTF and this whole process didn't recognize is that we have a subsistence and small business economy up here where people actually depend on being able to go and harvest seaweed or urchin or abalone or, in many cases for the tribes, subsistence fishing is a major part of their lifestyle. And until this group, this BRTF and their resources legacy folks came up here, they had very little understanding of what goes on the North Coast. I mean, one of the real objections we had was they were kind of applying this cookie-cutter process that may have applied in some areas of the South, but just really didn't have much application up here.
So what would be a better alternative to effort shift? I mean, eventually people are going to want to have to fish and harvest seafood and harvest seaweed off the coast. So what is an alternative? I mean, eventually there's some kind of balance has got to be struck. Is our coastline out of balance?
Yeah, I would say that you know, I'm not an expert on this. You know, I've lived here for 40 years, but I haven't lived on the coast, and I'm not a fisherman, and I'm not a seaweed gatherer. But just talking to my constituents and talking to people I know who are harvesters, we are not particularly out of balance. There have been so many laws that have come down to restrict the take of fish and other marine life over the last several decades.
Every year, the Pacific Fisheries Council comes out.
Yeah, we're closed, and we can't fish this, and this is off limits, and the season for this is almost non-existent. I mean, I think there's a real question as to whether the Marine Life Protection Act really had much to offer Northern California to begin with, and yet it was something that was, you know, kind of imposed upon us. And, you know, one thing that was really discouraging about this was that when we went to Wes Chesbro, you know, who's been representing this district in Sacramento for, you know, many, many years, you know, as a state senator.
Off and on for decades.
And then as an assemblyman, he said, well, there's really not very much I can do because this process has been given over to to this foundation, which is now in charge. And it won't be part of any public process until it gets to the Fish and Game Commission, which is an appointed body rather than elected body. So, in other words, what I'm saying is this whole process was taken out of the hands of elected representatives, and the attitude, particularly at the beginning, was that we don't really need to listen very much to anybody.
So one of the concerns that you have in the letter is an erroneous assumption that users of marine life protected areas currently are capable of simultaneously enacting conservation, restoration, or population and ecosystem enhancements. So that's, you know, kind of basically what you just reiterated. So what next? The Blue Ribbon Task Force oversaw the process. There was a community involvement, stakeholder community engagement process where the Blue Ribbon Task Force then took its recommendations and put them before the Fish and Game Commission.
Right.
Okay, so where are we at now? This has been a 3 to 4 year process. What next, Dan?
Well, where we are on the North Coast is that a week from tomorrow, there's a very important meeting in Eureka where the what's called the Unified Array, which is the consensus position of the counties of the North Coast, and that will be presented to the Fish and Game Commission. And we will, you know, basically be arguing for our position up here. Excuse me.
My understanding is that the Board of Supervisors haven't really come down, and this letter, actually, the Board of Supervisors didn't pass this letter, that you guys didn't vote on that.
Well, we came pretty close to coming to an agreement, but just over the last few days, I've encountered some resistance to our position. In other words, there are some, as I said a few minutes ago, there are some people who like this process better than others, and even some tribal groups that are more engaged than others. So what we have to do is find a place where the majority of our constituents feel comfortable with what we're doing. And I think we'll achieve that. It's not uncommon that some tribal groups will come out at a different place than other tribal groups. But I think one thing is really clear about this process, which is that without the input of the tribes, we would have come up with a much poorer product than what we did. And in fact, in July of 2010, there were about, the biggest rally since Redwood Summer. And I was just listening to Gerald Cherney, and it made me remember that July 1990 gathering in Fort Bragg. And we hadn't had a gathering in Fort Bragg that big since 1990, comparing that to the one we had in July of 2010 when, 400 or 500 Native Americans came to Fort Bragg and marched from the center of town into the Star Center, where they basically took control of the BRTF meeting and said, you are going to recognize tribal rights or this process is going to end right here. So that was very dramatic.
Okay. So, Dan, we're going to finish it up real fast. I've got a couple questions for you as we wrap it up, and I wanted to change the focus a little bit about the Mendocino County home foreclosures. There is Occupy Ukiah, Occupy Mendocino, want to see the Board of Supervisors enact some kind of a foreclosure prevention zone here in Mendocino County, even a moratorium on foreclosures. What do you think about that, and is that even possible for the supervisors to do?
Well, I think there's a lot of sympathy on the board. I became most aware. Well, I've been aware of this for a long time because we're all aware of how the banks.
We've got about 50 seconds left. So, okay. Is that possible? What can the supervisors do? Can you enact a moratorium on foreclosures in Mendocino County?
I don't actually know if we can do that or not. I do know that that Sue Ranichak, who is our county assessor, realizes that there's a problem here. And maybe it's not the 84% of irregularities that was found in San Francisco, but it is significant. And I think the board will be moving forward on a homeowner's bill of rights for Mendocino County. And I think we'll do whatever we can beyond that. I think the board was very glad to have Occupy Ukiah come into the boardroom, and I think we're basically very sympathetic with what they're saying.
All right, Dan Hamburg, 5th District Supervisor.
Thank you. We got through it.
Yes, we got through it. Thanks for being with us on KMEC here on the Mendocino Country Independent News Hour. I'm Christina Onnested, thanking you for listening.